If you want this podcast free of ads, follow us now on patreon.com/David McWilliams. Before we start, John, it's December. This is Discount December. We're going to give 10% discount on Patreon. And what you get for following us on Patreon is three things. Ad-free podcasts twice a week. You get two macroeconomic courses, not just one, two free. And also from January, I'm going to be answering questions once a fortnight. We're going to have an online macro session. And if you want to go up a level with us, you get a 10% discount for signing up on Patreon right now in December. Patreon.com/David McWilliams.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is podcast time. Hope all is well and you're kind of getting ready for Christmas. Did you see the Christmas tree, John?
I did. And the lads came up delivered it to the door, set it up.
We will talk to the lads in 2 seconds about the joys of doing podcasts. The upside of podcasts, the Christmas tree.
Absolutely. Poor old Mac, though, you have a bit of a flu.
I got the jab. Yeah. I am so immune now. It's ridiculous. I got the third.
I got to tell you, he's on the Lebsips.
I'm on the Lebsips. The worst is I got the jab and I was out of sorts for 2 days. Yeah. And then I've got a cold, so I'm on. Right?
I know,
yeah,
I can hear it.
Yeah. So apologise in advance, the podcast.
Were you on that weekend a number of years ago when it was my brother, Connor, and there was a few of the other lads, Cheers and E. McCool and the whole lot. And they were up in Donegal and the pubs had closed and they went back to the place they were staying and all they had was a bottle of vodka and no mixer.
I was not on that weekend.
Were you not on that weekend?
No mixer.
They had no mixer and they didn't know what to do except somebody had a packet of Lemsip.
No.
So they mixed up a packet of Lemsip.
I love it.
And used it as a mixer and they called the drink a mental breakdown.
I love it. Well, speaking of mental breakdowns,
yeah.
I spent, when I wasn't getting vaccinated, I spent the lion's share of the last week on your call is important to us.
Oh, yeah.
But all the lines are busy. Bank of Ireland.
Beep. Beep.
Unbelievable. I was waiting for 25 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, the whole thing. Extraordinary. And what I'm intrigued, all these companies, right?
Yeah.
Why don't they just employ more people? They can't find them because they pay the minimum wage.
That's true, yeah.
So people are not working for them.
Which is interesting because...
But you just think these all the consumer service, like all these... dealing with us, the consumer, right? Treating you appallingly all the time.
But they should be paying, you know, call centres because they're the front line.
We're having a chat on this podcast about the terrible service from Bank of Ireland, right?
Yeah.
Because...
And they wouldn't be alone now, in fairness.
No, they wouldn't be alone. AIB, every company, right?
Yeah.
But then I did a little bit of research and they outsource all these. Many companies outsource these to call centers, right? So it's got nothing to do with the actual company itself, right? And you would have thought this is incredibly irresponsible management of your brand, even if you are into this sort of carry on, that you would outsource the first interaction with consumers to people on the minimum wage. Who naturally don't care.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're just doing a gig. It's like a gateway job. They're doing it for a few months, right? And I presume the turnover is enormous in these things. Because if you're paying the minimum wage, people aren't going to stick around.
Yeah.
But you think a big brand.
It is like this, basic stuff. It's 101 stuff.
Yeah, I would have thought like you know, I know, yeah, you've got to save money and you've got to drive up shareholder value, you've got to make profit, yada, yada, yada. All that, we get all that stuff, right? But I would have thought that your first connection with your people, your customers, through these call centers, it seems to me to make no sense. So you'd be much better off spending 3, 4, 5 times the amount on customer care and not having people pissed off.
Well, you know, I do a lot of other podcasts as well. I produce podcasts. Well,
by the way, John is very promiscuous. He thinks he loves me. He says I love you, but he does other podcasts. I thought I was special.
No, you're the best, though, Max.
I thought I had all the tricks.
But they talk about customer service a lot. And the value of customer service, for all the reasons you just said, they are the front line. They are your first interaction.
Exactly.
And they are the face and the voice of the company. Why?
Why outsource this?
Why, well, not even outsource. I don't mind the outsourcing, but you need to have somebody who knows their product, who's passionate about the product, and who genuinely wants to help.
Like, I'm passionate about overdrafts, as are you. I was thinking with the bank. Just take out more money. Anyway, listen, we're going to leave our middle-aged men gripe over customer service, and we're going to talk a little bit about the biggest news maybe of the year, John, which is Russia.
Yeah.
Seems to be on the border of Ukraine, China, Taiwan, we've talked about before, and it's an extraordinary shift in geopolitics that nobody really saw coming, because the Ukrainian thing seems to have been off the agenda for a while and now it's right back on.
That's because, well, partly, I assume, because we in the West can only see things through the Western lens, because that's the only media and information we get. We're going to put a stop to that.
We are going to put, I'll actually tell you a story. Many years ago, John, I became obsessed, just after leaving university, with all what was going on in Eastern Europe. Remember the whole change?
Yeah.
And in the summer of 1988, it's a long, long time ago, I went to Czechoslovakia. Nobody ever went. I got a train, imagine this, from East Berlin to Prague. And the train went from Warsaw to Berlin to Prague to Budapest to Sofia and to Bucharest.
Wow.
So it went all around the Soviet bloc. And it was extraordinary because you got on the train and every single communist country was represented in each carriage. But the really, the East Germans looked down their nose and the East German guards.
But there was an East German carriage?
Yes, yes.
Oh, right, okay.
Because at every stage the train lost a carriage when it stopped, right? It was amazing.
It's very careless.
And there was what I always found was the East Germans were so horrible to the poor old Bulgarians. They thought the Bulgarians were the worst, right?
Who's last on the line?
Bulgarians, right?
All right, Bulgarians. So it was just one carriage pulled into the station.
But it was extraordinary. It was like this communist express all the way through. And Germany in the summer, so the Prague Spring is the 20th of August, the anniversary of the Prague Spring. Mm. And I wanted to go to Czechoslovakia because I'd been told that Prague was beautiful. But I'd never knew anything about it at that stage. This is before the stag parties and everybody, right? Yeah. But I'd been told it was beautiful. So I said, fine. I was living in Belgium. So I got the train to Belgium, to Berlin, blah, blah, blah. And what was amazing was the train, Central Europe is so hot in the summer. Like Germany gets so, so hot in the summer. And the train was kind of Deutsches Reichsbahn, was the name of the train company, the East German train company. It was really old. And I went through Dresden, right? This was 40 years after the Second World War. And most of Dresden was never rebuilt by the communists. They had no money. So Dresden was still crumbling.
Okay.
And then you arrive into Prague. And I got up out of the train station in Prague, down to Wenceslas Square. And there was a tiny demonstration. And from about 4 or 5 streets, cops came. And I've never seen people being beaten up like this. They let out Alsatians. They beat the lumps out of people. And of course I said, okay, time to leave. Mm. And I went into a little bar. And interesting, one of the guys at the bar said to me, where are you from? Ireland? What are you doing here? Because there was no tourists there at all. And I said, I just saw that demonstration. And I said, it was really vicious. He said, yeah, yeah. He said, how many people were there? I'd say about 200, maybe 300. And he said, yeah, 300, yeah. He says, 100 are actually demonstrators and 200 are agents of the state pretending to demonstrate to catch them out.
Oh, really?
And this is how they operated. And this was 88. And they said, this regime will never, ever end in Czechoslovakia. And within 18 months, it was gone. So it's interesting that these regimes, like, and you know, when you think about, and the reason I'm going to talk about is, if the Russians invade Ukraine,
yes,
they're going to do what they did in the Prague Spring. So they'll invade, they'll put their own people in power, and you'll have a proxy Russian state there for the next 20 or maybe 15 years, which would be an extraordinary thing. Because now, I thought that was all over.
Part of Putin's grand plan.
Yeah, and you think that's all over, but it's not.
Mm.
Anyway, let's go and talk to Gideon Rachman from the FT about what's going on in Russia.
Before we do, there are two fellas out here.
There's two young fellas here. Damien Mooney and Owen Cronin. And they have brought a Christmas tree.
Oh, well then.
This time last year, I got a text out of the blue from a young man called Damien Mooney and his mate, Owen Cronin, who are listeners to the podcast. And we were chatting about something. They said, would you like a Christmas tree?
Just out of the blue.
And I said I would. And they are now here again. The Christmas tree delivers. Owen and Damien, how are you, lads?
Good. How are you?
Very good. Glad to be here.
On a Saturday morning, waking up, bing, bong, two lads with a Christmas tree. What's the story? How are you, lads? You feeling a little bit ropey, you were saying?
We're good, yeah. We're a little bit ropey this morning. It's silly season. Silly season's been going already. But we're here. The Christmas tree's up. It's looking good. And two country lads getting the day out in Dunleary. You know, what's not to love?
And tell us, so you guys, were you economic students at one stage?
So I went to UL in Limerick. I did international business down there. And Owen went to UCC and studied engineering. And we both met at a Jolly Up in Budapest when we were in first year.
A Jolly Up.
Our first lad's holiday. We were the only two cultures in it. And we just hit it off from there.
And so you were listening to the podcast. How did we get in contact?
I actually messaged you on Patreon. So
yes, that's what it was.
I was doing an interview for a job at the time. I basically wanted to say that I was good at making contacts. So I decided I'd make a contact there and then just to have it for the interview. Unfortunately, I didn't get the job after.
Because you said, my contact is Dave McWilliams. You said, we're not having him. Exactly.
Straight red flag. It's something that has come in useful in the past this time of year that, you know, at least if you offer something and everyone puts up a Christmas tree in their house. So I just said, listen, if you have a quick phone call with me, I'll run you up a tree. And here we are.
That's what it was.
2 years later.
That's right. So Damien was doing an interview, contacted me in Patreon, said, listen, I've got a spoof properly. And he said, you're a good spoofer. So I said, I'll take a coffee, I'll explain
to you. Your skills and talent at spoofing widely known.
Are widely known, widely appreciated. And he didn't get the job.
Yeah, well.
And I got a Christmas tree. So who's winning?
Here we are.
Tell us about the Christmas trees. You have a Christmas tree farm, is it, down in...
Well, I don't have it yet. I'll probably have it like when the parents go on, but... my dad and my uncle set it up, nearly 40 years ago now. They got the farm off my grandfather. It was just open fields. He was a beef farmer. And they were like, nah, we're not having cows getting stuck in ditches and all that crap that goes with it. So the great thing about Christmas trees is they don't run away. They tend to stay where you put them. And there must be 100 Christmas tree farms in Ireland. We actually had the AGM at our farm. A few months ago, Owen drove all the way up from Clarity.
Come up to see us, all the Christmas tree farmers.
We call ourselves the Association of Christmas Tree Growers. But yeah, Owen's mates were all going golfing, and Owen said, "No."
What branch are you in? Boom, boom.
Oh God, Jesus! He's like this all the time. I've put up with this.
It's good thing he's good at his job, man.
No, it's good. Well, listen, we will leave it there, but it's great. Christmas, we'll see you this time next year, lads.
Please God.
That's Owen and Damon from the Christmas Tree Association.
Best of luck, lads.
Best of luck, lads. Thanks, we'll talk to you soon.
Excellent. Happy Christmas to you. Mac, take me back. Christmas is all about red and all that kind of stuff.
Red Russia and China.
Yeah.
But we're going to go to Gideon Rachman is the foreign correspondent of the FT. One of the greatest thinkers about international relations that there is out there. Great writer, all around good egg. And he's going to explain what's going on. He's on the line now. So it's Gideon Rachman from the FT. Gideon, how are you? Good to see you.
Yeah, I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm in flying form. Well, I'm actually not, because I got the booster yesterday, so I'm a little bit down. John's a bit worried about my sort of generally clogged up sound.
I'm always worried about you, Mac.
But I'm here. I'm full of paracetamol. All is good. Gideon, let's get straight to the issue. Russia, Putin, Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Where do you want to start? Where do we start? What's going on there?
Well, if we only knew. I mean, I think that, you know, possibly Putin knows, but certainly in the West, it's a guessing game. What we do know is that there's a buildup of 90,000 troops already on the Ukrainian border. The Americans are talking about them being able to mobilize 175,000 quite quickly, and there being an actual plan in place to invade in the early part of next year. Whether Putin literally pulls the trigger and does invade is the question for now. And what his motivation would be is also, you know, an interesting issue. But I think it's a kind of a major international crisis, which has slightly crept up on
us. Yeah, it's kind of crept up. I thought it was kind of like, I was aware of Donbass and obviously Crimea, but it seems to
go off, rumbling away,
and it's over there. But this idea, and I actually read it in the FT last weekend, when it said, actually, the Americans think the Russians are going to invade in the first quarter. It was very specific. So explain to me why now, what's been going on?
Well, firstly, one of the reasons that Putin's threats of violence are credible is he's done it before. So, you know, the guy's been in power now for 20 years. 2008, they attacked Georgia and essentially dislodged South Ossetia and so on. 2014, there's another war, this time with Ukraine, and they annex Crimea. So he has shown, and indeed when he came to power, there was the war in Chechnya and the leveling of Grozny. This is a guy, a rare world leader, who regularly resorts to the use of force. So
and
it's not
in Syria as well. He was not indeed, he was not ashamed indeed. Of anything they were doing there.
No, and they're still there. And who feels that his previous operations have worked for him, you know, that they helped him domestically. He's never been as popular in Russia as in 2014 after the annexation of Crimea. And he hasn't paid an unacceptable international price. You know, after the Crimean annexation, there were sanctions. It's inconvenient for the Russians, no doubt about it. But, you know, the Russia World Cup went ahead. He's still in international society. And then I think he will look at the United States and say they've just been through the Trump presidency. Biden's an old guy. They've just pulled out of Afghanistan. Are they really going to put up a fight? No. So then why might he want to do something now? I mean, I've talked about the domestic reasons.
Yeah.
But there is this sort of deep sense of grievance that Putin expresses quite regularly about Ukraine. If you can face it, there's like a 5,000-word essay he wrote on the subject in July.
Well, I was reading, you were writing about that the other day, the big tome. He published it, what, last summer, was it?
Yeah. And it's a sort of, you know, it's a historically based polemic, really. But the underlying logic of it is that Ukrainian independence should never have happened, that Ukraine and Russia are as one, that a series of mistakes by leaders in Moscow, including the leaders of the Soviet Union, and then sort of Western duplicity and Ukrainian neo-fascism has led us to this terrible pass. At one point, he makes a sort of pro forma, oh, okay, things change, you can be independent. But then he comes back and says, but, you know, you are being used as a springboard against Russia. The West is supplying you with weapons, that you want to join NATO. This is all unacceptable. And the Russians, in the context of Ukraine, but more generally, have been asking or demanding for some years that there should be a new security order agreed with Russia. The West has not been willing to have that conversation, but maybe under pressure, Biden is beginning to open the door to that a little. He talked after speaking to Putin on Wednesday, he said that there was going to be talk about a new arrangements in Europe. So Putin may be beginning to get that dialogue that he wants. The question then is, will that be enough? You know, firstly, will he ask for things the West is prepared to give? Such as saying, yeah, Ukraine will never join NATO. Well, people may feel uncomfortable about saying that, but as a matter of fact, Ukraine is miles from joining NATO anyway. So in a way, it's not that difficult a thing to say. But then the worry is, okay, you do that, and then he'll be back in a few years' time, because ultimately, he doesn't really accept Ukraine as an independent state.
Now, let's look at it from the Russian side. Before I kind of do my sedate in German, you know, at some stage, somebody's got to stand up to this geezer. Okay. But let's, from the Russian side, if you're sitting there in Russia and you see, look, you know, the Baltic states are in NATO. We've been surrounded by aggressors. We were actually the country that collapsed. And you are the aggressors. There was a period when our border was actually at the Volkswagen plant in West Germany. Not that long ago. It's in living memory, our border with the West. Now our border is in Belarus. Our border is in Ukraine. It's in Kiev. And you guys are aggressing against us. Mm. Well, what do you say to that Russian idea?
Well, I would say it's one way of looking at history and not my way. I think it's sincerely held amongst many of them. And there is a sort of sense that Russia was taken advantage of, that some of this was self-inflicted. Even Putin will say, well, we, you know, mismanaged things and so on. But the Russians will say, yes, but, you know, the West promised that NATO, that these states would not be taken into NATO. And then they were. And there's quite a lot of evidence for the fact that those promises were made. Now, the Western response is, yeah, but, you know, situations change and these countries asked to join NATO. And as, you know, NATO is a defensive alliance. It's not going to attack Russia. So that's how we see it. But they would say, well, we did see NATO go to war in Kosovo, you know. And in fact, one Russian once said to me, this was a long time ago, but it stuck in my head. You know, he said, you know, you bombed the Yugoslavs, or NATO bombed the Yugoslavs or the Serbs because they committed human rights abuses. But we commit human rights abuses in Chechnya. So if you can bomb Belgrade for them committing human rights abuses, why in theory couldn't you bomb Moscow?
So the precedence is there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think that's paranoid. And I also think it ignores the extent to which Russia was an aggressor. You know, that their view of world history sort of stops at 1945. You know, Napoleon invaded, Hitler invaded. But then actually, you know, Russia moved into, as you say, all the way up to the Volkswagen plant in West Germany, to the Berlin Wall. And, you know, there was no real, although the Russians would say the Warsaw Pact, NATO equivalents, the difference is that the countries that joined NATO did so voluntarily. I mean, the countries in the Warsaw Pact were essentially controlled by the Soviet Union against their will and got out of it as soon as they could.
So now that we're mentioning the Soviet and the Warsaw Pact, I mean, are we talking potentially Dubček, Czechoslovakia in 1968? Is that where we're at? Is that what this could look like? If mistakes are made.
If it went really, really wrong, sure. I mean, I think that most people think the Ukrainian army, if the Russians went for a full-on onslaught, would not be able to hold them back. And they could get to Kiev if they wanted to. And they would come up with some phony justification and they'd put their guy in charge. Ukraine might stay nominally independent state, but it would essentially be under Moscow's tutelage and control. That's possible. The question is, Biden has said, you know, you will pay an unacceptable economic price for that. How much more is there we can do to the Russians? And then how much pain are they prepared to suffer? I mean, I think you can probably, you know, for example, make it impossible for them to have interactions with the Western financial system. You can't transfer money in and out of Russia. That wasn't a big threat when you're the Soviet Union, but Russia's quite integrated into the global economy now. They won't be able to sell their bonds overseas. You know, you can create real chaos there. But equally, they have a weapon, which is that Germany is dependent on Russian gas supplies.
Exactly, and much more dependent.
Yeah, and going into the winter.
You know, yeah. So let's say the Russian side, they have this, we can turn on and off the heat, right? Mm-hmm. Which is real and it's material. The Western side is, we can punish you in bond markets, we can punish you by economic sanctions, we can make you a pariah state, more pariah than you feel you are. And you say, and of course he has form. He's done this before and he's got away with it. To what extent do you think this is a sort of an appeasement playing out? And it's not really appeasement, it's just the West's cards are, the hand is not particularly a good one.
No, because we know Biden's more or less said, we're not going to fight. And, you know, I think most people would agree with him that We don't want to go to war with Russia over Ukraine or anything else. And indeed, if you look back to the Cold War presence, you mentioned Czechoslovakia, 68, Hungary, 56. We didn't go to war then either. 21 years after Czechoslovakia, 68, the Soviet Union collapses anyway, or the Soviet system collapses anyway. So there is an argument for playing a long game, you know, and we don't have a very strong hand. And I think, you know, we may come on to this. This is, at the moment, the most severe bit of a series of global challenges to American power, some in China, some in the Middle East. And the fact that America is being challenged right across the globe makes it harder for them to respond.
And also, I might say, at the same time.
At the same time, exactly.
So let's talk about the challenges to America in China, in Taiwan, where you see it. I mean, and when I'm reading you, you're always traveling around. You're always talking to people. Well, by the way, just before you go, you've met Putin, haven't you?
Yeah, but not for a while. Yeah, no, I met him, God, can I say it, at the World Economic Forum in Davos. So they had a little kind of meeting for about 10, 15 journalists and Putin. It was, you know, not very grand. I mean, I've been inside the Kremlin not to see him. And those, you know, obviously that is an imperial setting. This was just the back room of a kind of 3-star hotel in Davos. And he sat there answering questions for quite a while, fairly patiently. He's a smart, if unsmiling, person. But the bit that I particularly remember was at a certain point, I can't even remember what it was, some American journalist asked him something he didn't like. And, you know, rather than answer the question, he said, well, that's a very good question, but before I answer it, could I ask you why you're wearing that extraordinary ring on your finger? And then sort of looked at this guy. This guy had a big sort of ring on his finger. And then everyone laughs a bit nervously. And then Putin says, oh, surely you don't mind me asking. You wouldn't be wearing something like that unless you were deliberately trying to draw attention to yourself. And so he basically kind of tortures this guy in public. And everyone forgets what the question is. He humiliates the questioner. It was a very kind of memorable, slightly creepy performance because you felt you were like watching an intelligence officer.
Turn the tables on some poor guy.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me about China. What do you think is the likely pathway? Taiwan, Xi Jinping, the whole change in China?
Well, I mean, China is going through a very weird phase at the moment for a number of reasons. And, you know, you kind of say I travel all the time, and I do, but obviously we've been traveling less because of COVID. And God knows when I'll ever get back to China. I mean, I used to go once a year, but they have adopted this zero COVID policy, which means that they're keeping up their quarantines from the rest of the world in a way that really no other big place is, and really nobody. So if you want to go to China now, you have to quarantine very strictly in a hotel for 3 weeks, 4 weeks if you want to go into Beijing, which means people aren't going.
Yeah,
because you've got to essentially commit to half a year to make that worthwhile. And similarly, the Chinese aren't leaving. So Xi Jinping has not met a foreign leader in person since March 2020, when he met the leader of Pakistan in Beijing. You will have noticed he didn't go to the climate summit. He didn't go to the UN. He didn't go to the G20 summit. He's become kind of recluse. And I don't think that is particularly good for, you know, a country that is huge and quite, like all big countries, very focused on itself. One slightly worries that they kind of lose touch, that they become prey to their own propaganda, which is very, very intense, because the other thing that's happening is that Xi is installing himself essentially as leader for life. You know, after Mao, the Chinese tried to move away from that. Deng Xiaoping introduced term limits for presidencies, and it worked for a while. You had Jiang Zemin did 2 terms, Hu Jintao did 2 terms. The collective party seemed to be in charge rather than a single individual. And then Xi comes in and essentially sort of restores aspects of Maoism. He starts writing Xi Jinping thought into the Chinese constitution. They scrap term limits. Now, you know, everybody has to study Xi Jinping. Last time I was there, you know, I was with a very kind of one of the rich Chinese guy, but he's also a party member. And so I sort of slightly teased him and said, you know, come on, you don't really study this stuff, do you? And he said, oh, yeah, I do. I've got the Xi Jinping Thought app on my phone. And he
pulls
it up. Yeah, absolutely. And they're meant to study an hour a day. And he said, oh, God, it shows I haven't logged in today.
Wow. That's bad.
It's crazy. Yeah. And so you've got a one party kind of cult of personality being installed, a one person cult of personality, a society that's cut off and that is increasingly to come to your original point about Taiwan, ferociously focused on the idea of reunification with Taiwan. In other words, just invading the place and conquering it.
And now that the Americans are compromised in Europe and all eyes are on Putin, do you think that there could be that disaster for the United States that both Russia and China move at the same time?
Well, funnily enough, that's what I'm writing my column about next week. And indeed, there's a third crisis, which, I should also include, although Russia and China is the two major locuses, but actually there's a crisis building with Iran as well. I mean, if you look at what the Americans have been saying, the Iranians are getting very close to, once again, to having enough fissile material to make a bomb. So there's something going on in the Middle East as well, which Blinken has said is, you know, can't go on for many more weeks. But yeah, Russia and China, I mean, you know, I talked to various kind of people in my sort of geopolitical world about, you know, do you think they're actually coordinating? And the view tends to be not in the sense of like, you know, secret communications and phone calls saying, you do this on Monday, I'll do this on Tuesday. That's not inconceivable. It's probably unlikely. But I think that they have a shared view. They have a shared problem, which is that there is territory that they want to annex. They have both taken notice of America's withdrawal from Afghanistan and incorporated it into a kind of rhetoric of American weakness. And they're both watching each other and watching, okay, what will America do in Ukraine? What will America do in Taiwan? What will America's allies do? Is this the moment now to move? Because the US won't react. And if they were to get away with it, both of them at the same time, then we're really in a new world of sort of Pax Americana is over.
Gideon, back in 2018, 2019, didn't China and Russia have kind of military maneuvers, joint military maneuvers and kind of war games, kind of prepping for this?
They've done that. And also more recently, there were big Russian-Chinese naval exercises in the Western Pacific. But, you know, they would say, well, you guys do that sort of thing as well. You know, NATO has war games. And indeed, there were very large naval exercises. Last time I was in Washington, which was in October, the Americans were slightly crowing because they had said that they had conducted the biggest naval exercises in the Western Pacific in 40 years, involving the Japanese, the Australians, the Americans, the British, the French. Everybody's flexing their muscles right now.
So let's just, before we go, Gideon, let's look at that scenario where either coordinated or opportunistically, you have two big powers with a mutual interest, which is to annex territory and kind of humiliate America as well.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's that, you know, at the end of the day, they want America to look weak. They want America to be weak. Mm. Do you think this is a possibility?
Yeah. I would think it's probably more likely at the moment that over the coming year, the Russians will do something, then the Chinese will do something. That's partly because, simply responding to what's actually happening, you don't see quite the same military buildup with Taiwan. There's a huge number of Chinese incursions into Taiwanese airspace and forcing of the Taiwanese Air Force to scramble and that kind of thing. But, you know, invading across a stretch of water is much more complicated than just rolling your tanks over a border. So it's easier to do Ukraine than it is to do Taiwan. Also, China has been much more cautious militarily. They had a little clash with the Indian Army on their border last summer. Some people killed, but not. It was more like a kind of, you know, overflowing of tensions rather than a deliberate land grab of the sort that we've discussed that Putin's done in the past. They haven't fought a war really since they had a war with Vietnam in 1979. They've had a huge military buildup that since then. There's a lot of nationalism around. There's a military that's keen to kind of show its mettle.
Yeah, to show its stuff. Yeah.
But, you know, a seaborne invasion over a stretch of water, which is, I think, three times the stretch you had to cross during D-Day, even to do a, you know, take over an island of 27 million people, which is tiny compared to 1.4 billion people, and it would be, they'd lose people, they'd lose ships. And they would also, I think, they have to think about, in the best case scenario, America doesn't respond. But then America, even if they're not in a war with America, globalization's over at that point. I can't imagine, you know, trade as normal. You know, there would be complete economic sanctions on China. It would be economic chaos. are they prepared for that? Do they want that? They're the world's largest manufacturer, the world's largest exporter. They ready to find Western markets closed to them? I don't know. Maybe.
Well, I mean, we'll leave it there. But I mean, you would think that all logic would say, don't do that, right? All logic.
Yeah.
Well, wasn't that the great book that was written in 1913 or something that said, you know, there won't be a war in Europe because economically we're far too integrated.
Yeah, the Germans it was Norman Angel's The Great Illusion. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And the Germans and the Brits and the French. And we might like each other, but frankly, we're all far too economically intertwined to do anything as stupid as attack each other. That. And it happened.
Absolutely. And in fact, now we're swapping great books. There's the one I was reading and then I've lost. So I just reordered it. But there's a really good book by a guy called Ian Kershaw, who was famous as a historian of Hitler. But it was called, I think, Fateful Moments or something like that. But it's about a study of 1939 to 41 and the decisions that were made in Berlin, Tokyo, etc. about invading Russia, about Pearl Harbor, etc. But the attack on Japan is particularly interesting because, you know, the Japanese war-gamed Pearl Harbor internally in the imperial cabinet for a very long time. And a lot of people were saying internally in Tokyo, this would be crazy. You know, we'll lose this war if we do this. But they still did it. You know, people can do very, very irrational things. They talk themselves into a situation where, for whatever reason, they feel they have no option or this is the best option.
Or they construct a fantastical situation where they might possibly win, even though probabilistically it's almost zero. But they construct that and they go through that little gap in the door, you know? And that, that's the weird thing that happened. Gideon, we will leave it there. It's obviously a pre-Christmas chill has come into the podcast studio, the basement, the HQ of the podcast. But no, fascinating stuff. And isn't it amazing just how quickly these things can change? You know, who was talking last summer about either of these things, really?
Well, yeah. I mean, let's hope in 6 months' time we'll forget we ever had this conversation because the world will have moved on and it'll all have been a scare. But we'll see.
Gideon, thank you so much for taking the call. Good to talk to you. Take care.
Nice to talk to you, David.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You know, Mark,
you have a very solemn face on you now, John, after that interview.
Way back when I was working in World Service, George W. Bush, now he wasn't the sharpest tool in the kit.
Oh, yeah.
But he said once that I looked into Putin's eyes and I saw his soul, which kind of meant nothing because he didn't get him at all.
He didn't get him at all. Well, also, it's not just W. Barack Obama said about Putin, dismissed Putin, said he's not a chess player. And I said, I felt like saying, ah, here, that's
really?
Exactly
Did he say
what
that?
He is. Yeah, that's exactly what he is.
Well, that story about the ring.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I could imagine that happening. I could envisage that happening.
And as you said, it's a trained agent turning the tables. Mm. And deflecting completely.
And focusing in on a little detail.
Yeah, but what comes across from that conversation, and, you know, we've been having the conversation ourselves, is just how fragile the West's hand is in the face of Russia.
Yeah, I think
and
so.
And China, but particularly Russia. Particularly Russia, because, you know, you impose sanctions. Yeah, they work. Russia's been under sanctions since Crimea.
Yeah.
And then Mickey Mouse sanctions. And maybe you do it full on. But there's also this playbook that you can see Putin playing, which is the following. Putin knows that Biden's out in 2 years, right? He probably has a fairly good handle that the Democrats might lose in 2 years. Then he might have a Republican, a Trump, or a kind of a wannabe Trump. Okay?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who's view on foreign policy is informed by big, big boys, tough guys, you know, right? And Putin's thinking to himself, I can brazen this out for 2 years. Then we have a new president. Then he's going to do a deal with me because he can't go in to 4 years of presidency with Russia being shut out, invading half of Ukraine and all of Europe petrified every winter that they'll turn on and off the gas.
Yeah.
I mean, he does 2 years and then he's like, okay, then there's a clean slate. We negotiate again.
But I wonder, would he even bother waiting the 2 years? Because Biden...
No, I'm saying do something now.
Yes.
Take 2 years of being frozen out by Biden.
Yeah.
Knowing full well the chance of Biden winning or the Democrats winning are, you know, 50-50.
Yeah.
You'll get a mini Trump coming back in there. You say to them, okay, the first thing you got to do is have a summit with Russia. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
And then they already own Ukraine.
Yeah. And what strikes me is the fact that it's the Russia-China...
At the same time idea.
At the same time. And who are talking? And that's why I was asking Gideon about these maneuvers. And not only that, but their trade ties are much closer now as well. So it is the prime time to do something. They have Lukashenko manning the border there with Poland and just shoving people at the bottom, just building up the pressure.
Yeah.
They have China building up the pressure on Taiwan. They have Putin with his hand, as you say, on the gas knob.
And knowing that he'll be very popular at home if he invades Ukraine.
Absolutely.
You know, that,
and then also, you know, Trump has left America as a laughingstock, a divided...
Certainly in this basement.
Yes.
but maybe it's high time to short the market, John.
Oh, go on, talk to me.
Well, if all this is... even if there's a risk of all this, right? The attendant risk is therefore... that global financial markets unbelievably overvalued, right?
Yeah.
All dependent on the Fed cutting interest rates. All that sort of stuff about COVID and cutting interest rates and tapering and bond markets, that'll all count for shite if Russia invades Ukraine.
Yeah.
There'll be a dramatic fall off because first thing was the price of oil will go through the roof because there'll be sanctions on Russian oil.
Right.
And Russia produces a hell of a lot of oil, so there'll be certainly a glut, right? Then the Saudi Arabians will have to produce much more oil to bring the price down, but they've got an interest in the price being up because it makes them rich, right?
Yeah.
And they're trying to maneuver away from oil into all sorts of notions of being the great leaders in there, so they might not necessarily come to our aid straight away.
Right.
Okay, if you think of the Chinese are then given a green light to... even if they don't attack Taiwan, it's on the agenda.
Yes.
Completely. It won't go off the agenda from then on because Ukraine will look like a proxy Taiwan. Financial markets will collapse all over. I mean, there'll be a huge shock to the system. Globalization is over. Supply chains, there's no more
being
out in Asia. I mean, this is, and I come back, we probably end here. The extraordinary thing about the First World War was that the stock markets, you know the way everyone says, oh, don't worry, stock markets, financial markets and economists, they're always one step ahead. They think ahead, they discount risk, etc. The First World War started on the 3rd of August. European stock markets were open on the 2nd, trading buoyantly.
Right.
Nobody forecasted. Everyone thought, you know, as I said, far too many links, still be a 11th hour deal, the Germans will back down, the Serbs will back down, the Austrians will back down against the Serbs, the Russians don't want to get involved, the French aren't prepared, the Brits clearly don't want a war in Europe because they've got their empire. All these logical, rational ideas will come to the fore. And by Christmas, they were all bogged down in the Western Front, in the Eastern Front, in Turkey, and we had a four-year war. We're thinking about
it. Jesus.
There goes John. Jesus. Talk to you Thursday. John, it's Crimbo.
It is.
Here's the sales pitch. You can get, can you imagine anything better than this? You can get 12 months Patreon subscription to the Dave McQueen's podcast, which is two podcasts ad-free every week. You get two macroeconomic courses, the economic courses I give in Trinity, more or less online.
Which are humdingers.
Which are humdingers, okay, which we actually won a prize.
Indeed.
We won a prize.
Indeed.
Swati Teacher of the Year. But we get all the reading lists. You know the reading lists I go on about? All the reading lists, the lecture notes, videos, the whole thing. And you get these, we're going to introduce this year, an online Q&A. Once a fortnight, I'm going to answer the questions that people have. This is all on Patreon.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, no, it will be really good. And it'll create a huge community of people. This is all on Patreon. And you get a 10% discount if you sign up in December. So that's patreon.com/Dave McWilliams. And if you sign up now to Patreon, you get 12 months for the price of 11 months for an annual subscription. And, or you can look at it by getting 10% off for the whole thing. And the key thing is, it's not just the podcast. It's the learning, it's the community, it's the engagement, it's all together. We're going to go up a level
in
2022.
Do you know what as well? It's a bloody brilliant Christmas present.
You're absolutely right.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.